You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Before we dive into the podcast, I just wanted to give you a quick note. Sports are back. That means you can save 40% over at The Athletic. Don't miss exclusive in-depth coverage of this unprecedented sports season. You can subscribe now and save. If you sign up now for The Athletic, you can see for yourself the creativity, reporting, and storytelling that sets The Athletic apart. And if you go to theathletic.com/gametheory, you can receive 40% off of an annual subscription. You won't want to miss the breaking stories on your favorite teams. You won't want to miss the in-depth coverage that The Athletic provides. So go to theathletic.com/gametheory for 40% off an annual subscription. We hope to see you there. Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini, presented by The Athletic. I've got a nice little two-part episode for you today. In the first part, I've got Dave Dufour here, and we are going to do overreactions to what we've seen so far in the NBA's scrimmages, because if there's anything that is more fun than overreacting to two games after we haven't seen basketball in nearly 4 months, I don't know what it is. The second part of this podcast is going to be an interview with Baylor center Freddie Gillespie. I had a really great, like, 35-minute conversation with Freddie just about his incredible journey. He has gone from having not played organized basketball until the eighth grade to becoming a legitimate NBA prospect, and all of the twists and turns in his journey, such as starting at Division III Carleton before ending up transferring to Baylor and sitting out a year to really improve his game. So it was a really fun conversation. I hope you guys will enjoy that. But first, Dave Dufour is here. Dave, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Not bad. I'm ready.
I couldn't have imagined a better person to have a wild overreaction podcast with you.
Now, I don't know if is that a compliment or is that a backhanded compliment? Is that, should I feel insulted?
Oh, I think
that
you should feel enthusiastic about the NBA season returning.
Yeah, I am. I am. The hot take cannon is ready to fire. I am fired up. I'm treating these scrimmages like Eastern Conference Finals, Western Conference Finals, Game 7s.
Love it. Love it. That's what we need in life. So the idea of what we're going to do here is we are trying to overreact to what some of the biggest stories have been so far in the bubble. Our goal is simply to make this as fun and patently somewhat ridiculous as possible. Like, we're going to throw some shit at the wall that is going to sound ridiculous. It's meant to sound ridiculous on purpose in order to foster a conversation about where all of these guys are. And I think that Dave's first topic is probably the one that has gotten the most publicity so far from the scrimmages, right?
Yeah. Listen, Bol Bol is the future of the NBA. Tall Ball is here to stay.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's an interesting one. So give me your opinion on why this is a thing so far.
Well, with Bol, you can play him with Jokic. As a matter of fact, they kind of complement each other. And then when you think about how weird the deployment of Jokic is defensively, where he really almost defends more like a guard, having Bol as like a weak side help guy really bolsters that defense if he can figure out, you know, how to be effective for an entire possession and not just on the ones where he can come in and get a block.
Yeah, I think he's actually been pretty bad defensively.
Sure. Yeah. His feet are awful. His timing is bad. He's just blocking shots because he's, you know, he's got the longest arms in the league. But when you consider the way he cuts offensively and how that works around Jokic, I mean, they're running Bol off DHOs, and I mean, they're doing all kinds of interesting things, and you can't teach height. So yeah, tall Bol is here because of Bol Bol.
I'm like intrigued by Bol, and I think he's been better than what certainly I anticipated coming into the scrimmages and what I anticipated for his rookie year. So I don't want to like take that away from him, right? Like, I think that it's important to keep this in context that he was the 44th or 45th overall pick last year. He also has now scored something like, isn't it 29 points on 35 shots or 34 shots? Has turned it over, I think, 9 or 10 times, and is shooting 28% from three. So what is the idea of Bol Bol is incredible, and he is 20 years old, and I think that there is a lot of upside here, and to ignore the upside that Bol Bol has would be wrong, and
wouldn't be fun, right?
But I'm very, very skeptical, and that's even before we get to the defense, where I don't think there's any way you can play him with Jokic on defense. Like, I just don't think that lineup has nearly enough mobility.
I'm going to disagree. I think for the zone, it's fine. He just has to recognize when, you know, what his role is and when to step up.
I mean, are they going to play full time zone?
Sure, when he's out there for 8 minutes.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that being a thing when he's out there for 8 minutes. Their lineups so far have just been so ridiculous and like enjoyable, and what I would hope that teams would get out of these scrimmages where they're playing Jokic, Grant, Torrey Craig, Bol Bol, and Mason Plumlee in the starting lineup together. The only thing I feel like we haven't seen is Noah Vonleh enter the starting lineup to play in these minutes. So like they're not taking this these scrimmages as anything more than getting a chance to check out who they have and some of the weird lineups they can play and maybe can't play.
Yeah.
So yep. I think that's smart. I think the way Denver is handling this is definitely a route. But the Bol Bol idea is intriguing, and I'll be interested to see how many minutes he plays in an actual playoff setting. Like, how many minutes would you see for Bol?
Are we saying my dream scenario or in real life?
Let's go both.
My dream scenario is that he's able to legitimately contribute for like 12 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, it is.
The realistic scenario is he's going to get some garbage time minutes. That's it. You know, like, and who knows how much the Nuggets are going to see in garbage time, but that's all I expect him to play.
Yeah. I think I'm with you. I think at some point in the playoffs, they're going to try and see what happens with him. Like, they're just going to throw him out there, like, in an actual spot and see if he can make it work. It will probably just be a tester scenario, but I bet it happens, and we'll see what happens. Other than that, I agree with you. I think he's probably just going to get garbage time. So my first wild take here is that the Thunder might have real wings. This has been a problem for them all year. It's why they've had to play these three point guard lineups, but I really like what I've seen from Lu Dort so far in the scrimmages, and part of this is just because he plays really hard and you don't have to worry about him playing hard in a scrimmage setting, right? But he also knocked down 2 threes against Philadelphia. Andre Robertson has looked good. Like, I think he's actually looked really, really good in the 2 games that he's played so far. He did knock down those two enormous threes late in the game against Philadelphia. And if they can get real wing play, this team does get somewhat more dangerous in a hurry, I think.
I agree with you. And as a matter of fact, I don't even think it's that's a hot take that they might have.
Well, I was going to go with this for the hot take. Did Andre Robertson learn to shoot?
It looks so much better. It looks so much better. I mean, listen, I mean, I've taught a lot of people how to shoot a basketball, and I mean, professionally, that shot looks objectively better.
It's like in Happy Gilmore when he starts using the hockey stick as a putter and then just walks up to Shooter McGavin and goes, oh, Happy learned how to putt.
Right.
This is where we're at. This is Andre Robertson right now. This is his new shooting form is Happy Gilmore with a hockey stick.
Oh, my God. I hope that's how it works out. It'd be great. It'd be a good story.
I'd love it. I'd love it so much. I like, their ceiling is incredibly higher, though. If he and Lou Dort, they can get 48 minutes out of them at the wing position. And, like, 48 competent minutes on both ends at the wing position.
I mean, that's a big deal. Obviously, wing is, you know, that's where all the value is in the NBA, you know. It is a wing-dominated league. And so if you can get guys that can be two-way players on the wing, that's huge, and especially on that contract that they've got Dort on.
Yeah. Is it you and I that talked about how that was, yeah, like, the worst contract that I've seen signed? The scrimmages have done very little to make me believe anything but that Lugenstort contract is going to be really, really good.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, Dave, give me your second overreaction.
Ben Simmons, now that he's got the three ball, is a top 10 player in the NBA.
Ooh.
Because those two threes that we've seen are all the sample size I need. As a matter of fact, I will be honest on this. That second one that he made with zero hesitation is the most hopeful three-pointer made in NBA history. I'm not even kidding.
So
I'm not even kidding because there was zero hesitation. He just shot it like he was supposed to. And immediately after that, Memphis started guarding him on the perimeter.
Yeah.
Kyle Anderson stopped sagging off like he was a non-threat. It just changes the geometry for them.
It absolutely does. It changes their trajectory entirely. It changes the geometry of the floor, like you said. It opens things up in a really substantial way. Shake Milton has been pretty good so far. Mm-hmm. Like, he hasn't been incredible, but he's been pretty good manning the point guard position. And Ben was really good against Oklahoma City, obviously knocked down the shots against Memphis. It was good to see Ben Simmons confidently take those threes against Memphis. I would have liked to see him take more against Oklahoma City. Unfortunately, he did not. And that brought things back down to earth for me a little bit.
Yeah, we need to see more, for sure.
Yeah, that's a concern for Ben. You said he's a top-10 player. Why is he a top-10 player with a jump shot?
I mean, he's already, you know, one of the two or three most impactful defenders in the league.
Agree. Yeah,
and offensively, his limitation is the jump shot. And the free throws, and it creates other issues for him. And I think just having the threat of a jumper is even more important than the reality of a jumper, at least right now. I think that it's obviously the one missing piece of his game is to be able to shoot the jump shot. It also just helps with the fit around Embiid. And even when Horford's out there, obviously we've been talking about Ben Simmons needing a jumper since he got into the league. Actually, before he even got in the league. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a big deal. He's already a top 30 player with no jump shot.
Yeah, I'd even go higher than that. Like, I think he's probably top 22-ish.
He might
guy.
Be. I mean, yeah, he's going to get a lot of All-NBA votes, and he's going to be on the all-defensive first team.
Yep. And he should be on both of those teams. So I'm going to be really interested to see how voters handle him. I'm going to be really interested to see how seriously teams take the jump shot in the playoffs. Because if they do take it seriously and they continue to fall for that Joel Embiid pump fake for some ungodly reason, they actually can kind of space the floor in a competent way. But that's a lot of ifs for a team that has been just a total mess throughout the course of the season. I will be very interested to see how they actually use Al Horford in the playoffs. This is a weird team, and I don't think we really have any sort of clarity here on the Philadelphia 76ers unless Ben Simmons is actually going to shoot at least 3 three-pointers a game, and he still hasn't done that yet. He just has to shoot them, and he has to make them at like a 33% clip.
Right.
Like, I'm not asking a lot. I just need a little bit. And you know, one team that I tangentially mentioned within that idea of what we saw from the 76ers is the Memphis Grizzlies. The Grizzlies have not looked good. These are mm-hmm. your Memphis Grizzlies, Dave Dufour.
They are mine. They are mine. I've been banging that drum all year, even though I did say that they were going to have the worst record in the league.
They are really not very good right now in the scrimmages, and that's okay. It's a good time to get the bad out is during these scrimmages, right? They are basically like playing full lineups. Like, you know, look, Dylan Brooks played 27 minutes against Houston yesterday. I think he's probably going to be up around like 35. So it's not like they're getting crazy, like full minutes for everyone. Jaren Jackson only played 21 minutes because he had 6 fouls. I think that he'll probably avoid.
So about normal. No, about normal.
I was gonna make a good case for Jaren, but, you know, I think the fouling is obviously an issue. But, you know, they're actually playing the semblance of a real rotation right now, which is a little bit scary to me, that they look as bad as they do. Like, Russell Westbrook did not look great yesterday. Like, he was not. Like, he had, like, 8 points on 3 of 14 shooting. And they got beaten by Ben McLemore and Jeff Green. And on one hand, you can say, well, Jeff Green and Ben McLemore aren't going to combine for 44 points every night. Like, what can you do? The other part of that is, look, the Grizzlies just got worked by Ben McLemore and Jeff Green. That's a cause for concern, right? What do we think of Memphis going into this restart? Because I actually am a little bit worried based off of those scrimmages.
Listen, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they succeeded above what the indicators say they should. You know, they kind of outperform their metrics. It's a young team, so inconsistency should be expected. I'm not too worried, and I still think the math just is in their favor when it comes to, you know, hanging on to the 8 seed.
I agree with you that the math is in their favor, especially if Zion Williamson doesn't quite come back. Having said that, like, another hot take that I wanted to give but didn't was Portland, I think, looks pretty good. Like, I know they lost to Toronto yesterday, but...
Well, no Lillard.
Yeah, no Lillard, first and foremost. And, like, that Toronto team played a lot of their normal rotation. Like, they played Paul Watson 15 minutes and Matt Thomas 18 minutes, but, like, Terrence Davis played 20 minutes. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson played 20 minutes. Norman Powell played 22 minutes. Kyle Lowry played 22 minutes. Their bigs played 25 and 24 minutes, respectively. Really, only Marc Gasol and Fred VanVleet were the guys that didn't play a ton. So, for Portland to, like, fight like this and for Yusuf Nurkic to look as solid as he does, I'm still a little bit worried about how he's going to score around the basket right now, but he looks pretty solid. Zach Collins, I thought, was moving well, at least out on the court. And, you know, given that it was a shoulder injury, you would expect him to be moving well. I actually think Portland looks pretty good and is going to really scratch and claw with Memphis for that 8 seed.
I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't be shocked. Especially since we don't really know what's going on with Zion.
Yeah, the Zion thing is a bit strange. We're, you know, going to see him, I think, for the first time, not even in their last scrimmage game, but in their opener, right?
Right.
So that's going to be a critical one for Zion. They need to get off strong. And Zion needs to get off strong because I don't think they can catch Memphis without a full strength Zion Williamson. Now, maybe he is just in complete and total shape. And the reports are accurate, and he's just going to come out and wreck worlds, but we'll see. Dave, give me your last hot take based off of what we've seen in Orlando during these scrimmages so far.
The Celtics should just go ahead and make Marcus Smart the starting point guard from here on out.
This is a take. So
We already know he's an all-NBA defender.
Right.
But did you know he's one of the best passers in the NBA?
Is he?
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's a great passer. I just think that for what they do offensively, he brings just as much as Kemba. Not that Kemba is not a superior offensive player, but the gap is so wide defensively that I just think Marcus Smart is better for this team.
I think that there is a case to be made that in this 2020 playoffs, given that Kemba Walker has injury issues that he's dealing with in regard to this knee, he only played 9 minutes against Phoenix. I did not think he looked particularly great in those 9 minutes. I do have some pretty real concerns about how they're going to go about handling this entire situation in the playoffs, because they do need a full strength Kemba, I think, to challenge Milwaukee. I don't think, and frankly, it has to do with depth, right? Like, they just don't have enough bench guys to be able to afford losing Kemba Walker, in my opinion. Even if you want to bring, like, Kemba off the bench and get, hopefully, 20 minutes a night, like, that'd be a huge win for them, even if he's not 100%. But then again, you just sign Kemba Walker to a four-year deal, and you have a much longer runway than this season to go out and win a title, so you probably don't want to use Kemba Walker if he's limited in any way, because you don't want to make the injury worse in any regard, because that contract has a chance to get ugly pretty quickly if Kemba Walker is not his full self. So I'm not saying like Boston's in trouble by any stretch, but I'm very intrigued to see how they handle the Kemba Walker situation in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, pretty obvious they're going to treat him with kid's gloves. So, you know, that's a lot of money and a bunch of years left. So, you know, his long-term health has to take priority.
I think that you're right on that, and that does get into Marcus Smart. And I do agree with you that Marcus Smart is probably the best option to play the lion's share of the minutes at one. You're also going to have Gordon Hayward initiating sets. You're going to have Jason Tatum initiating sets. Like, you know, they're going to do it by committee, I think, if Kemba isn't 100%. But I think there is, like, a very real case that Marcus Smart is a better option in the playoffs right now, given Kemba's limitations physically.
Uh-huh. For sure. For sure. I just don't see how Kemba is going to get into game shape ahead of the playoffs.
Yeah, based off of what we've seen so far, I think there are pretty real causes for concern. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he's not, like, taking it super seriously either. Yeah. Like, he's just kind of working his way back in. I would want to see him play more than 9 minutes in their last scrimmage game here. But we'll see. I'm not worried about Boston, but, like, I think that there are causes for concern. And, you know, their game against Phoenix leads into my last overreaction, which was, Mikal Bridges is going to make the all-defense team next year.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
Like, it's going to require voters figuring out how good he is on defense.
Yeah.
I fucked up not putting him on my top 50 rookie scale guys ranking. Uh-huh. Like, that's an error. That's my bad.
Oh, yeah.
That's Phoenix fans. This is my apology. I'm sorry.
Well, it's just so easy to overlook.
Yeah.
Right?
It is a little bit easy to overlook. That was bad, not putting Mikal Bridges on that top 50.
I'll tell you what. Hey, and they're showing in these scrimmages that they've got him doing a little bit more with the ball in his hands, which I think is going to be hugely important for them. He's already a defensive nightmare.
He
can competently shoot threes. That dude is good. That dude's really good. I mean, he's a legitimate ceiling raiser for that team. If everything starts coming together,
he is the way that he mirrors other wings' footwork is insane. The way that he uses his length to recover and contest is insane. Everything that he does on defense, I just love it. He is so good at getting into like little passing lanes. He's actually a pretty real weak side rotational threat. I don't want to say like rim protector, but sometimes he will come over and block a shot. I think there's a good chance we're talking about him the same way that we talked about Jonathan Isaac this year, where By the way, if Mikal Bridges is going to make the all-defense team next year, he has to beat out all of Jonathan Isaac, OG Anunoby, Kawhi Leonard, all of these great defenders across the NBA, some of whom aren't even going to make the all-defense team this year.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there, our own John Hollinger even gave him six-man love.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Interesting choice by Hollinger. I don't know if I would have gone that far, but I think he's really good, and that's before we even get into, like, the real defensive, you know, player of the year contenders, right? Which is, you know, Jonathan Tatacumpo, Anthony Davis, Bam Adebayo might end up as a forward at some point, depending on how they decide to deploy him in Miami, you know, similarly to Anthony Davis. This is a loaded, loaded forward group. Maybe at some point he can get in on the guard teams, right? Like maybe Phoenix would be smart to make that push where it's like he's competing against Patrick Beverley, Eric Bledsoe, and like Drew Holiday, Marcus Smart, and even like Ben Simmons, right? Like I think that's a better pathway to making the all-defense team, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Even though he's listed as a forward right now. But yeah, Mikal Bridges is an absolute monster. He is so good on defense. He is.
That possession against Tatum, that's going to be an eye-opener for a lot of people. It's going to be on a lot of season previews for Phoenix next year.
100%. And it made me go back and like really watch a lot of Mikal Bridges' tape yesterday. I was like, okay, how badly did I fuck up not putting him on my top 50 rookie scale guys?
I mean, he's in Phoenix, so I get it.
Yeah, I even watch a lot of Phoenix. Like, I watch a lot of DeAndre Ayton stuff, and I think DeAndre was really good on defense this year. I just it was a blind spot, apparently. I fucked up on that one. Like, it just is what it is.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah, we all screw up. Dave, do you have any more hot takes you want to get out there before we depart?
Not really.
Not really.
Just that the Bucks are going to win the title, but that's not a hot take.
That's not a hot take. It's going to be fun to see how the Bucks manage this Eastern Conference because it seems like a lot of people are trying to create excuses to not pick the Bucks.
Right.
And that's a bit strange to me given what we've seen from them this year.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Dave, do you have anything coming up on The Athletic that you want to plug?
I mean, we've got all our previews coming out this week at The Athletic. You know, I mean, all of the beat writers, even me, Danny, and Seth chipped in on a few teams. And then our season previews on The Athletic NBA show all week.
Go listen to The Athletic NBA show. Go listen.
Oh, and I almost forgot. The Daily Ding is back. We have games this week, so the Ding will be back.
That's fantastic. Go listen to The Ding. Go listen to The Athletic NBA show. Go read all of the previews that our great staff is putting out. I will have a big board up tomorrow, an updated top 100 NBA draft prospects listing. So go read that. Go subscribe to The Athletic in order to do so. I will be right back with an interview with Freddie Gillespie. Before we get to Freddie, I have another quick advertisement. This time it's for DraftKings. The final 22 teams have made their way down to Orlando and are ready to get back onto the court. While the ending to this year's basketball season will be different than years past, there will be no shortage of excitement. And there is no better place to get in on all of the action than with DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy sports. To celebrate the return of basketball, DraftKings will have not one, but two $1 million top prizes through the first 2 days of the resumed season. So get in on all of the action now. If you haven't tried it yet, fantasy basketball is easy to play. Just pick 8 players, stay under the salary cap, and pile up points for three-pointers, rebounds, assists, and more. There's no better way to put your basketball knowledge to the test than to compete for a shot at $1 million. But if basketball isn't for you, don't worry. DraftKings is offering plenty of fantasy golf action for this week's tournament with millions of dollars up for grabs this week. There is no better place to have to get in the game than with DraftKings. I've been getting in on some MLB action. I am a big fan of DraftKings. Download the DraftKings app now and use promo code RUN to get a free shot at $1 million up for grabs this week with your first deposit. That's promo code RUN to get a free shot at millions of dollars with your first deposit only at DraftKings. There's a minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Now, let's get to Freddie Gillespie. All right, welcome back to the Game Theory Podcast. I've got a great guest here. It's Freddie Gillespie, who was a forward slash center, big man from Baylor this year. He was the Big 12's most improved player. He was a second-team All-Big 12 member, first-team All-Defense in the Big 12. If I was, you know, putting together All-Defense teams across all of college basketball last season, Freddie certainly would have been one of my top 10 guys all across the country. And his story is just kind of unbelievable and remarkable in so many different ways, because he didn't pick up basketball on an organized level until he was in the eighth grade and started out at a D3. So I'm really excited to talk to Freddie Gillespie, who also, by the way, was on the list of the 105 players that would be invited to the NBA Draft Combine if there ever is an NBA Draft Combine. So, Freddie, it's good to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really good. It's, you know, nice sunny day in Miami, so I can't complain.
Oh, man. Anytime you're in Miami, I feel like it's a dream. Maybe not because you might not be able to go outside as much right now, but
oh, man,
that's great. So the first thing I'm doing with everyone is just asking them first to describe their game. This is largely an NBA audience that listens to this podcast, even though you've been on national TV seemingly every game this year. A lot of people that listen to this show haven't gotten a chance to watch you play. So if you had to describe your game, how would you do so?
I'm definitely a defensive-oriented, rebounded-minded player. I think that's probably what stands out when anyone watches me play. So when it comes to defense, you know, I'm a shot blocker. I like to roam the paint. You know, I've got some versatility in that, you know, I can guard all three levels, guard still working on becoming really, you know, good on, you know, point guards, some faster shooting guards, but I can contain on the perimeter. That's one of my skills. And then rebounding, offensive rebounding, that's my particular specialty. That's where I take pride in. Getting my team extra possessions, finishing and doing things like that. And then on the offensive end, I'm screening. Now, I'm not like a pick and roll guy. I'm a big pick and roll guy. I'm not a pick and pop guy. It's just a shooting. Now I actually have a pretty good 3-point shot in the corner since I've been working out here in Miami. But if you were to watch me play before, you know, the mid-range, you know, maybe longer twos was kind of my distance where I was most comfortable at. That's what I shot the most. But yeah, that's kind of my all-around game though.
Yeah, top 10 in the country last year in offensive rebounding. Certainly a guy that can knock down a mid-range shot, and then obviously someone who can block shots. And we'll get there in a minute. But before we do, I just want to give you a chance to tell your story. So like I said before, you didn't play organized basketball until eighth grade. You started out when you were a younger athlete playing football, from what I know. And then from there, I'd kind of just love if you can, you know, explain your journey, and maybe from there I'll ask some questions that kind of pop into my head.
Football was my first love, always. I think back then it was, you know, I grew up in Minnesota, so it was Dante Culpepper and kind of Randy Moss.
I love that,
you know,
so much.
People were looking at. So, football was my first love. And then, I get to, you know, eighth grade, and then, you know, his coach, name is David Battle, comes to me and says, hey, you know, I wasn't tall. I just kind of had long arms. I had really long arms. He said, hey, you should come try and play basketball. You're a pretty good athlete, long arms. That could bode well for you. So I just go out there, play with my friends, have fun. Didn't take it seriously at all. I didn't really know the rules. I just kind of was running around out there, and then moved on to ninth grade. And then in ninth grade,
By the way, how tall are you at this time?
At this time, I'm about 5'8", 5'9". About as tall as most of my other peers, most of my other friends. I didn't really stand out too much. And then ninth grade comes, play football, and I try out for the basketball team because I'm like, okay, well, I played last year, so I'll try it again this year. And I broke my ankle. Yeah, and then so I'm going on, and then I'm thinking, okay, after that, I'm like, I'm done with basketball, probably not going to play. Didn't even take it that seriously. Then the B team coach came to me and said, hey, I really want you to play. And at this point, I'd grown between the freshman and sophomore year, I'd grown from like 5'10 to like 6'4, 6'5. So I had a huge growth spurt. So in his head, he was like, you need to play. So I said, okay, I go out there and I start playing. And then that's when I kind of fell in love with the game, when I started to have a passion. I don't know why it clicked for me that year. That's when I really just wanted to play basketball. It was like just so much fun. And I kind of started to learn the rules more. And, I became more competitive at it. And I got that energy in me. Sophomore, junior year, senior year, as I continued my career playing basketball, injuries kind of played a part in it. You know, I got a Jones fracture there, broken ankle there again, a torn ACL, missed it so I can play AU. That's kind of what led me that's why I went to Carleton College, which is a D3 school. Went off to there because I just couldn't quite. When I was in high school, I couldn't play AAU, struggling with injuries. You know, at that point, you know, the best thing for you is to get better. You know, is to like play the game and get better. So I was very raw. So Carleton College is like, hey, we can use your size, this and that. We'll take a chance on you. The injuries kind of went away, and I kind of just got the ability to be on the floor more. And then my game started to kind of grow and develop, and I got simple, like, post moves down. Like, nothing really crazy, but it became more, like, active, athletic, and started to show, you know, some promise of becoming a real basketball player. And that's when my desire and thirst to play the next level kind of really started to get my passion kind of grew, and I knew I wanted to play with the best, and I went to Baylor.
So you didn't really even think about like pro basketball as a path until your second year at Carleton College.
Yeah, before that I was getting ready to majoring in computer science and was thinking I might go work for Amazon as a software engineer or something.
And now here you are.
Man,
you are
in
a very real spot. So how do you end up going from Carleton, which is in Minnesota, to Baylor? Carleton, for people who don't know, is like a very high-end liberal arts college, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah, correct.
So like one of the top 10 liberal arts colleges in the country. And then you go to Baylor, which is another good school. But what is the connection there?
So, you know, I told my mom about it. I wanted to transfer, go to a higher level. We had a family friend. His name is Al Nunez. And, you know, he's kind of big in the Minnesota basketball scene. You know, if I know it's a name that people, you know, across the country are familiar with. But you know, if you're playing in the Twin Cities, you've probably heard of him.
Former player at Minnesota. I believe he was on their staff, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, for a little bit. Yeah, he was. So, impressive. Okay, so, yeah. So, I reached out to him. My mom did. We had a conversation. He said, He said, right now, we need development, and you need to be at a good place with good coaching and good resources. And I think Baylor might be that place for you. And I have a son on staff, Coach New. He's at Baylor. We call him Coach New. It's Coach Nunes, but he's at Baylor. He went to talk to Coach Drew, and then a couple weeks later, Coach Drew happened to be in the area recruiting Trey Jones, and he said, after he went to go recruit Trey Jones, he's like, I'll stop by and talk to Freddie too, and see what this kid's about. And we came in, had a conversation, asked me about just everything about my life, just different things, and kind of how this interview went. Kind of just asked about my basketball history, and then said, you should come down and take a visit, and then so that I could walk on their team.
So your first year, you're a walk on, mm-hmm. and kind of paying your own way, and you're practicing with the team. You redshirt that year. What was the adjustment like in terms of going from D3 Carleton all the way up to Big 12 basketball?
Here's what I tell people the biggest adjustment is. So the biggest adjustment was when I was at Carleton, there was only I was the only one that looked like me in terms of like height, size, athleticism, all that. There's just no one there that could really quite match me in any of that. When I went to Baylor, when I first walked in, I remember is that I was no longer the tallest guy there. I was one of the fastest guys, could jump the highest, wasn't the quick, like, everyone there, like, you know, and walking in at 6'9", that wasn't, I mean, there was, what, I think, we had, on that team, there were six players that were 6'9", or taller, if I remember correctly.
You would have been 2017-18 would have been that year, so that was Joe Luala-Chule's year.
Yeah, he was there, and then TJ Madsen was there, he was 6'9", Nuno Mott was 6'9", Tristan was a freshman, he's 6'10 now. At the time, he was 6'9". So, and then there's a guy named Leonard Allen. He's the brother of Jared Allen. He was on campus for that year. He was 7 feet. So it was, that was the biggest wake up. And then you got a guy like Mark Vidal, who's 6'4", 6'5", but he plays like he's 6'9", 6'10".
Yeah, that dude just looks like he wants to fight everyone on the court at all times. Yeah. And he looks like he would win every single fight on the court.
So, yeah. That's a very good, that's very perceptive. But that was the biggest adjustment in terms of, was this thing walking in and having to figure out, okay, you have to have something else in order to be good at this level.
What I was told, like, early on in your career at Baylor was just, like, it was hard for you to even just, like, adjust to the speed with which people played and having your hands up at all times because guards can kind of hit you from all angles. I would imagine you, like, really struggled early on. How did you fight through those struggles and get through the early parts of that development process?
Like you said, catch the ball, just even the simple things of basketball, just like, you know, because again, like the guards there, they can make reads really, really quick. They're very, very reactionary. So it was a big adjustment. Said the way that I adjusted to that was a lot of times now I would do individual workouts and it was just very like basketball, just like the basic versus the basketball. Where, you know, I would just stand there and just someone would just chuck balls at me as hard as possible and I have to one after another I have to try to catch them all. Just simple things like that. Or, you know, catching and getting it up off the glass quick. Just the very, you know, or like I said, or like the big one was the miking drill. Just, okay, just, and it's like, you know, move your feet quick. Things like that, trying to get adjusted. It's just, it wasn't the fancy drills that you see a lot of guys do now in the NBA workouts. That wasn't it. It was, honestly, probably someone who was like 11, 12, it's something like that they might work on.
But you weren't playing basketball when you were 11 or 12.
So I had to start there, yeah.
Yeah, you had to start there, and then you had to keep getting better and better. I mean, at what point in your career at Baylor did you really feel like, okay, I've got this shit figured out?
I think it was probably about, I remember it was that second semester, and it was around February, it was in February. Mm-hmm. And I remember because I was playing and, you know.
Yeah, you were like a part-time starter your junior year.
My junior year, so this was still my first year there. So.
Cool.
So, yeah, I think, you know, I was as that same group I just mentioned, TJ, you know, Joe, Lachie, Williams. We're playing 5-on-5 scrimmaging in practice, doing what we usually do. And I think, you know, it clicked because one day, you know, I was guarding Joe, and, you know, he went 0 for 8 on the post with me or something crazy, like some nuts like that. He missed everything. And I realized, and he tried to tell me it was because, like, you know, he just had a bad day. But I was like, no, I was playing good defense. I kind of can play defense now. and then people try to dunk, and I used to always get dunked on, but then I could jump up quick enough where I could, you know, start to block the shot. And, in the pick and roll, I was like, wait, you know, one time in the pick and roll, Coach John Jacobs, he told me, he was like, you know, you become a really good, like roller in the pick and roll. So, and I realized these things, and I wasn't, like, crazy out of this world good, but I knew, okay, now I can hold my own. And now I got a base I can build from.
What's funny is, like, the way that you play defense and the way that you, particularly the thing that's really impressive to me about your game is your sense of timing and the ability that you have to time when another player is going up to shoot. You time your leap really well to match that player, and because of your length, you know, you're just obviously going to be an impediment around the basket. And the way that you time your pick and roll defense, for instance, even if you're not necessarily switching out onto guards, even just, you know, kind of sliding or, you know, hedging out onto a ball screen or something like that. Like, you guys played a lot of man-to-man defense this year.
Yeah.
In comparison to the past when you guys typically played like a 1-3-1 zone at Baylor, like kind of a hybrid weird zone even. It's not even always like 1-3-1. But in large part, like, I feel like it was because you unlocked a lot for Baylor to be able to do that because of your timing and your footwork and your ability and help defense. Where did that stuff kind of get itself figured out?
Yeah, so for me, ever since even when I was young, so even when I played football, I always wanted to be on the defense side of the ball. I always knew I wanted to be, you know, like a middle linebacker, outside linebacker. That's what I always wanted to be, you know. I was always watching Ray Lewis. That's the guy. So I was always wanting to be, and so that translated into basketball as well. When I first started playing basketball, and I always enjoyed the defensive side of the ball way more than I did the offensive side of the ball. So that's just kind of how, like, I just kind of naturally, where I naturally gravitate to. But when it came to Baylor, I think, so for me, when I first got there, I was like such a raw product that they kind of could like mold me into kind of like what they needed from me. So they're like, look, they're like, so, you know, where some guys that come, they might be ingrained that, oh, this is just how I play defense. I'm just not a good defender. This is that. Like, I didn't have those mental blocks, I think. So when I got there, they're just kind of like training me to become like, you know, a guy that could switch out, you know, a guy that could, you know, shot block, well, wasn't a natural shot blocker, but, you know, how to really work on timing and, you know, not following all these things to kind of, like, really drill into me. I kind of, and I gravitated towards them because I enjoyed that part of the game. So I think, you know, Baylor kind of got blessed with me in terms of, like, a blank slate. And then, you know, I'm a pretty quick learner. So that's kind of what I adopted and kind of became my game.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who study computer science, like, by trade, tend to have, like, this innate intellectual curiosity, right?
Yeah.
And, like, this desire to learn. Do you feel like that's kind of how you are? You're just a very intellectually curious person, and then once you decide you want to learn something, you kind of, like, sponge it up?
100%. That's kind of how I've been. If you talk to my mom, I'm sure she'll say the same thing, but that's kind of, you know, how I've been. And especially with basketball, I mean, you know, I love to study the game. I love to watch film. I love to break it down. I love the technical aspects of it, the nuances of the game, you know, all those parts.
So that was going to be kind of my next thing that I wanted to lead into, because as I've, you know, said throughout this and as you've said to start, you are someone who, you know, derives a majority of your impact on defense. Coming from Carleton, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, you guys aren't playing defense in Minnesota, right? But it's a different ball game going up to the Big 12. How much of your improvement just came from learning and watching tape and then really just, like, deep diving into learning different offensive schemes, learning exactly what you needed to do? How much of your improvement can be boiled down to watching as much tape as humanly possible?
So, one thing I love about defense is that, you know, there's only so many ways that you can run a pick and roll. You know, there's, I mean, you know, guys, I know people are always thinking innovative with basketball, but, you know, there's only so many ways you can run a pick and roll, only so many ways you can do a down screen or, you know, flex or a flare screen and all that. So, you know, once you, you know, study and figure out how to guard it, you know, this is the matter of applying it to a real game scenario. So it was a huge part. But go look at how these actions were done, what they're trying to get on it. And then, you know, trying it. And then I'm like, okay, when I know how to guard it, then, you know, just, you know, you're not just committed and then be committed to making it happen. And I think a lot of guys look at defense as an obligation. Well, like, when you start looking at it as, you know, something that you want to do as bad as offense, it becomes a lot easier when you have that motivation to do it. So that's kind of what I put in myself. Watching film, like, again, do your homework, the coaching, the scouting reports. While some players might just briefly look at them and not take them seriously, that's the cheat sheet. You know what a player wants to do in their tendencies, it makes the game a whole lot easier. So I think that mental aspect of the defense side of the ball, you know, is, I mean, of course, you have to be just a natural athlete and have good instincts as well. But, you know, I'd say that, you know, about 60% maybe, depending, I'd say anywhere from 40 to 60%. Because some guys are so good, it's just too good that, like, they're just going to find a way. But so I'd say 40 to 60% is on that, is focusing on that, the mental aspect of it.
So you guys had, for my money, three of the best 10 defenders in the country, and you, Mark Vital, and Davion Mitchell. Which one of you three is best and why? And why is it you?
Okay. So which one of us is best? See, that's so tough.
You guys do so many different things. Like, you play so many different roles.
Here's why I say that. I think Mark, and for me, it's because, you know, his effort and play just sets the tone for the rest of the team on defense. Mm-hmm. He really set the tone on defense. Two, I'd say his ability to really just, like, he truly can guard 1 through 5. Like, some people say, like, oh yeah, I can, like, some people can contain the perimeter, but, you know, they can slow down the big or they can front the big, but he really can, like, you know, go out there and guard the point guard full court if he wants to, and then go down there and get in there with a 6'10". 280-pound big, and, you know, keep him out the paint and make him take a tough jumper. So he can really do both. So that's why I say that's why I would say Mark, because his versatility is just unbelievable.
Obviously, I think you would say that offense is the biggest place where your game has room for growth. Mm-hmm. Where, I guess, like, I would ask you, what are you working on right now to try and improve that offensive side of your game?
So a big thing is just, you know, they said just what I've worked on here and is just understanding the offense, just understanding NBA actions, understanding what guards like to do. You know, a lot of dribble handoff, things like that. You know, knowing when to screen, re-screen, when to roll to the rim, when to pop. You know, where to cut when a guy is going ISO, things like that. Just or how to make cuts, all those things. You know, off-ball screening, all the actions that, you know, dominate the NBA. Because reality is, you know, I mean, in the foreseeable, I don't want to say I'll never be able to do it, but in the foreseeable future, you know, I don't see myself, you know, okay, being the guy that initiates the offense with the ball at the top of the key. So I'm being a ball dominant player. So just working on all that off ball cutting, things like that. Keeping it simple, yeah. So working on those off ball screens, the off ball cutting action. And then the next part is, you know, getting to that 3-point shot. And I've started in the corners. One, because I think that's where people, or that's where, you know, a more common shot for, you know, 4 or 5 is that corner three. So I've worked in there and I've gotten pretty good at it, but still improving. So working on expanding my range.
Yeah, it's so interesting because if you're going to play the five, like you almost need to have the above the break three because you're going to be initiating sets with a screen with your ball handler above the break. And then if you play the four, it is almost always the corner, you know, short corner extended out to the 3-point line. So kind of figuring out where you need to start is kind of difficult.
It is.
For guys that are improving or and they're as thoughtful as you are in regard to this stuff. I love the fact that you're working on just different ways to screen. I think that's such an essential part. Like, one of my favorite guys in this draft class is Xavier Tillman, and he just has so many different ways to screen. He knows how to reverse screens and flip screens, and he has, like, the little ass-out screen that, you know, gets him a little bit quicker of a head of steam if he's going toward the basket. What are you kind of working through in regard to footwork on screen setting? Because I would imagine that, you know, as you've already said, you feel like that's the biggest place that you can make an impact. And I think that's super, super smart and insightful in regard to your understanding of what your role is going to be.
Yeah. So out here, one thing that I didn't like quite, you know, didn't quite expect, but is the emphasis on footwork. It's everything, whether it's ball handling, setting screens, everything on offense, you know, they're always emphasizing footwork. They're like they want really efficient movements. That's what's been taught to me. You want efficient movements because, you know, they say guys are just too good at that level where you got to really, like, capitalize those little small battles you can win by stepping with the right in this situation but the left in that situation. So, yeah, that's something that's been emphasized with me, especially, like, so when coming out of screens and going into screens and things like that. And that's something I've been working on as well. And they've been trying to do other things with me. Like, I've done, like, a lot of ladders and hurdles and, you know, beach workouts to try and get, get better footwork so it can translate to the court.
So, unsurprisingly, given this route that you've taken, you've developed a pretty real reputation for being an incredible worker. From NBA scouts I've talked to, from the Baylor staff that I've talked to, everyone has just kind of talked about how unbelievably hard you've worked to get to where you are now. What does a typical day look like for you right now in regard to trying to work through everything? What did a typical day look like for you at Baylor as you were trying to figure out how to get better at this game to reach your fullest potential?
So here, I'm training out here in Miami. We train 6 days a week. So it changes on how long, you know, on what from day to day. Some days we have to try to keep it a lot lighter to keep us from fatiguing. So one of the heavier days, I'll go with that. It can go where I wake up. I can get to the gym at like 9, go get breakfast. Get to the gym, you know, about 10:30. And then we'll get there and I'll have like a weightlifting session. And sometimes weightlifting sessions can go from like 1 hour to 2 hours, depending on what the day is. So it might be like a series, like a mobility movement and like stretching to work on, a mobility thing to work on athleticism and moving, and then an actual weightlift to, you know, work on strength. So, you know, that might go 1.5 to 2 hours. And then we'll take us to, you know, maybe, 12 or 1. And then from there, I'm on the court. So if I'm on the court, then, you know, I'll get there with the trainer out here, and they'll have me work on whatever it is that day that they want to emphasize. Might be a, you know, footwork day, you know, might be a ball handling day, might be shooting, you know, different combination of them all. So I'll do that. That'll be like 1 hour. That can go anywhere from like 1 hour to 1 hour, 30 minutes. Then after that, you know, a lot of times we might play ones or 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, depending on who's there, depending on the numbers we have. A lot less now since Corona kind of spiked back up here, but before we did that a lot. So we would do that, and then, you know, that might take us to, who knows, like, you know, 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. And then after that, you might go on the gun and get some shots up. Maybe get up a, you know, they might have you get up 500 sets, 700, 800 shots, depending on how your legs feel, you know, depending on how hard that day was. And they're kind of out of there by 4 o'clock. So that's one of the longer days that I've had. You know, you're there from like maybe, you know, 10:30 to 4. Sometimes, you know, you might come back and shoot later or depending on what you do. But a lot of times, you know, since you're there for 5-6 hours, you kind of go back and just kind of rest, recover. For me, at night, usually I'll pick a couple games to watch because I know League Pass was free. It's not anymore. But when it was free, pick a couple games to watch. And from this past season, break that down. I was trying to study some of that, some of those clips.
Come on, man. The least your agents can do is spring for a League Pass.
I might have to ask now. Before I'd have to ask, now I might have to ask. Like, look, or give me your account. I'm like, what's the login for your account? I know you have one.
Give me a quick run through on the Baylor one too.
Yeah, Baylor was a little bit more simple. It was just, you know, get up at maybe, you know, I think I had class at 9, so get up at like 8, go to class, and then usually you're in class from like 9 to 12 or 9 to 1. Then you get lunch, head over to the gym, then you do your treatment in the training room. You do your treatment. You might get a quick workout in, a quick shooting in with one of the GAs. You might grab them and have them rebound for you. Then we have practice, which, you know, was like lifting, film, and on the court. And then you do after practice, and you go, and then you might get a little more thing in after practice, and then go get some after practice treatment, and then go get dinner, and then you're back at home. You might come back later and shoot at night.
Give me the pitch on why an NBA team should select you.
Well, one, first off, I'm the person that will put in the work no matter the situation. You know, out here, I've worked very, very hard. And my trainers will tell you that. I bring the focus and intensity every single day to try to get better because I understand the opportunity that's here. And I want to get better. I want to be the best. So I've shown that from the first from high. If you look at, because if they can find film from high school, it's a D3 to my first year, Baylor to my last year. They'll see improvement every single year. It's just there because I put the work in every single year. They'll see improvement this next year. So, and then on top of that, you know, I'm not a low maintenance guy. I'm a no maintenance type of person. For me, I'm like, you know, I just for me, you don't have to worry about me coming to the gym, me being on time. You don't have to worry about me being early because I'll be the first one there. I'm a no maintenance guy. I'm that's the type of person I am. But yeah, also then other things I offer on the court logistically that we spoke about earlier. I think that kind of stuff speaks for itself, and that's only going to get better. So, but the more I learn, the more I grow.
I love I'm not a low maintenance guy. I'm a no maintenance guy. That is an incredible line.
Yeah, okay.
You need to use that in every interview possible.
All right.
So before we get into a few fun questions to finish up, back in June, you tweeted about an experience that you had where you were pulled over by a police officer and you were very concerned, and you tweeted this back in June. I believe it was, what was the timing around that? Because George Floyd was late June, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think it was a week or two after after George Floyd's murder.
You tweeted, and I'm just going to quote the tweet. Okay. I was pulled over late one night. When told to step out of the car, the officer asked, "Why do you look so nervous?" I told him, "To be honest, I'm worried. I don't know if you're one of the good ones or one of the bad ones." He said all that stuff in the media was fake news. Doesn't feel so fake now. You know, you grew up in a town in Minnesota or city that was 80% white and only 5% black.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did that experience kind of inform the way that you look at the world? And I mean, how is all of everything that's happened around the country in regard to people becoming more activated, trying to protest racial injustices like this around the country, how has that impacted you and the way that you've kind of looked at the world?
So, yeah, like you said, I grew up in a very majority white town. And for me, though, you know, so one thing my mom did, like, growing up is, you know, she wanted to make sure that, you know, I saw all different types of environments. So during the summertime, you know, a lot of times I would go back to Mississippi, where she was raised, and spend time there a lot of summers, which was that area. It was majority black. You know, it was like the area she grew up in was more like 60% black, 40% white. And then a lot of times she would send me over, you know, to different summer camps, you know, either in St. Paul, Minneapolis, that were maybe not majority black, but more like 50-50 black-white. Just kind of see, you know, different, you know, areas, different, you know, and the different environments, different atmospheres. All to say is, you know, I've seen, like, different, you know, way races interact in different circles when in different, with different varying percentages and things like that. So I feel like I've got a very good grasp on, you know, the inner workings of these things. But, you know, in terms of how it shaped, you know, my views, like, now, like, growing up and my views now, I think for me, growing up, like once around, you know, like particularly, you know, maybe majority white places and, you know, places where, you know, that majority black. Like for me, what I saw one was just kind of like, I realized, like, okay, I'm like, yeah, we're all in the same place. We're all here, but there are still, you know, stereotypes that exist and assumptions that exist that I might are like, you know, these little like microaggressions. So for example, you know, growing up, one thing I always heard is from people is that, you know, and I, especially in high school, but even middle school, you know, people would tell me, this is my white class, they would say, you know, Freddie, they'd say, you know, you don't talk black, right? So, right, I said, I said, I don't talk black, and they said, and they would say, oh, yeah, no. So then I said, oh, okay, and I asked, I was like, okay, well, how does a black person talk? And they're like, you know, I'm like, no, I'm like, imitate it for me, like, tell me how a black person talks, I'm like, imitate it. And then they didn't want to imitate it, because I'm like, yeah, I'm like, because you realize that what they're saying, you know, inherently has a very stereotypical, like, racist hint to it. Yeah. Just that statement. I'm like, so my dad, that you're playing off a stereotype that you think exists, but, you know, you can't talk in a race. You talk, like, you know, you just talk how you talk. So things like that. Kind of, it was kind of like, you know, that, like, that level. There's a lot of things, like, I could give hundreds of examples, but it was things like that that I heard where I was like, okay, this is, you're saying this and you have a stereotype in your head and that's not good. So I kind of like saw that exist when I was growing up. And to comment word, the tweet that I made out to speak on that, you know, that's the biggest thing I heard, is that people would be like, racism doesn't exist anymore, like, you know, in a post-racial society, things like that. And I was like, okay, is it better than it was before? Yes, but I was like, I wouldn't say it doesn't exist. And I tweeted that out to show that, because essentially that, you know, that I was like, you know, when some people, because a friend had told me, I'm like, when you're pulled over, like, you don't, like, that doesn't even cross your mind. I was like, but for me, like, that's something that was in the back of my head. I was like, okay, this, you know, I don't want to mess up here or do the wrong thing, because, you know, that this could be the end of me. You know, that's something I have to consider. Right. I was like, consider and think about. And so that's just.
And like, in general, you're a big dude, too.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, I'm like, if someone knows me, you know, I don't, they might not know. I'm like, oh, I'm just a nice guy. Not a big size. You know, I consider myself a pretty good human being. But like I said, in that moment. But then, you know, like, the kind of the police dismissed it as me, just, he kind of dismissed it as that doesn't exist. But I was like, I think it, for me, I was showing, like, with that police officer, I was like, I think he was wrong. I think it does exist. But, you know, and, you know, I went on my way. He let me off with the warning. There was no issue. That's what I was trying to show, was that, okay, like, there's this little, like, kind of, like you talk black, like, you know, I mean, I think people can see clear racism. Like, if someone comes out and says, I hate black people, you know, you see, okay,
right,
yeah, he's racist, okay. But if, you know, someone says, no, okay, like, you talk, hey, like, why don't you talk black, or why don't you act black, you know, in that, there's stereotype in your mind that you're perpetuating, that, you know, that you don't want, that you're not really addressing, but that's not okay. I'm like, you have an idea of that. So that was kind of my point there.
Well, I'm really glad that you felt comfortable enough to share that story publicly. And, you know, on the last episode of the podcast, I had Cassius Winston on, and he's been very loud and vocal in regard to some of the experiences he's had and about some of the injustices that he sees being perpetuated around the country. How important do you think it is, as you enter this realm of professional basketball and, you know, start to gain a platform, how important is it to you to be able to use that voice and use that platform to try and advocate for what are essentially human rights versus, you know, when people try and distill this to a political issue, which it's not.
Yeah. So for me, you know, I think it's very important. I think it's, you know, one of the great things about sports is that it brings people together of all different, you know, races, culture, religions, for like a common cause. You know, sports. You know, so You know, so yeah, like people disagree, you know, on new, conservative and liberal, and you know, that kind of like brings out like some discomfort and awkwardness. It's like, oh, like some contention. But you know, the great thing about sports is that, you know, you can disagree about LeBron and Jordan, who's the best of all time, but you know, you can still laugh and joke and be more, and it's just, you know, at the end of the day, you know, there's no hurt feelings over it. So that's what I think the great thing about sports is, but also since it has such an important place in culture and, you know, in particularly American culture, I think when there's no gross injustice or a gross wrong, then it's clearly in the picture and not just, you know, that, and it's for any group, you know, I think they have an obligation of being on that platform, you know, with great power becomes great responsibility, as they say, to speak on it and to talk about it and bring it to the forefront. Because since sports is kind of in the forefront of America, so it's one of those things that's kind of an American culture that's in the forefront. When players say things on it, it brings it to the forefront, and you know, helps maybe those marginalized groups that maybe don't have a voice, you know, have a voice. So I'd say it's very important.
I'm really glad that there are more athletes like you and like Cassius that I talked to on Thursday on the podcast that are willing to voice that, because I think that that's the best and, I don't want to say easiest way, but the best way for people to gain awareness. Yeah. Of it and to learn that there are very real issues. Like I grew up in like a similar situation to you where I think there were five or six people of color in my graduating high school class. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, I just think about what I didn't know back then and think about what I know now from a lot of the experiences that have shaped me. And, you know, I think it's really, really important that we start to talk about this more. The last three questions I have for you are going to be more fun questions. So the first one here is, in your career at Baylor, who was the best player you faced and why?
Best player I faced on, like, another team or, like, because, I mean, one time, like, Jonathan Motley would come through all the time, and he was one of the best players I faced, so.
Let's go with another team.
Another team, okay. You know what? I'm going to say Brandon Clark in the Gonzaga tournament. I mean, at the NCAA tournament, second round, Brandon Clark was the best player I faced. He's with Memphis now, but, yeah, he was just, again, his second jump, his athleticism and his kind of understanding of the game. I think even now he has like one of the best like efficiency ratings in the NBA, if I'm correct. I think I saw that. But he just really like understands his role and his place, and he knows where to be, and he knows how to play off the ball. He can, you know, and his ability to jump is just next level. So
it's
I'd
ridiculous.
Say Brandon Clark.
He's so ridiculous with just the leap. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, he's not the biggest name, but I'd say he's someone that I was like, he really understands what he needs to do in order to help his team win, and I think that's what makes the Grizzlies so good.
Yeah, I had Brandon as a lottery pick last year. I felt pretty good about that, even though he went I think 22nd, 21st.
Yeah, yeah.
So now that you've had some time on your hands, you know, you said that you're done working out around 4 o'clock, 4:30. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine you don't know a crazy amount of people in Miami right now. Mm-hmm. I would think that you're spending some time watching some TV, watching some movies.
Yeah.
What are the favorite things that you've seen so far during the pandemic?
Let's see. Okay. So I went back and started watching White Collar, which is an older show. Uh-huh. I watched that. Let's see. That's a pretty good one. But let me think. The best one that I've watched. That's a good question. Okay, so there's a show on Netflix called Dynasty, and it's a reboot of an old like soap opera show called Dynasty.
Yep.
That's probably the best show I've watched, just because it's like really entertaining. It has like crazy plot lines, crazy twists. There's a couple of plot holes, but it doesn't matter because it keeps your attention, and it's like three seasons long, so it passes the time. So that's probably the best one.
Oh, I love that. That's a wild show. That's just a wild show. Yeah. And the last question I'm going to ask you, you're going to get a contract to play professional basketball somewhere, you know, whether it's a guaranteed deal, a two-way deal, if you get drafted, don't get drafted, whatever. You're going to get some sort of money. What's the first thing that you want to buy with your first professional basketball contract?
The first thing I want to buy, let me think. Probably a car. So that's probably the first thing I want to buy is a car. And right now I have a 2008 Honda Accord that gave me all types of problems throughout college, like just where there were several stints at a time I couldn't even use it. I was just sitting there because it just didn't work or didn't run or didn't even move. So I had to wait to get it fixed. But, you know, I don't even want, like a Lamborghini or anything like that. I just want, like...
You want a functioning car.
I just want a functioning car. That's it. Just one like that's dependable, where I just only have to worry about getting the oil change, getting air in the tires, you know, getting tune-ups. Just that's it. That's okay. A functioning car would be what it's the first thing I would buy.
Oh my God, I love that answer so much. Mm-hmm. That's been Freddie Gillespie. He's gonna, you know, whether or not you get drafted or not, I'm super glad that you were able to come through on the podcast, because this was a super, super fun interview. Thank you so much for taking the time. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please rate, review, subscribe, all that stuff. Whatever you do to support the podcast, that'd be great. And we'll be back later this week with more. So until next time, we'll talk soon.